Barry Holborn, a fantastic record, arguably one of the, well, he is certainly one of the best British riders that's ever ridden these specialist events. Fifth place in the Tour of Flanders, third in Paris-Roubaix, and of course, the only British winner of Gent-Wevelgem. Good morning, Barry.
Good morning to you.
Hello. When you were racing, was it all this like golden week? Was it Tour of Flanders first and then Gent-Wevelgem on Wednesday, or was there a week apart like they are now?
No, Gent-Wevelgem was in the time, always on in midweek, one in the Wednesday.
Right. So what I wanted to do then was take it from Flanders, from your recollections of the Tour of Flanders, certainly the 1967 and the 1969 events, which you played a massive part in, and then talk about Gent-Wevelgem and then talk about Paris-Roubaix.
The Tour of Flanders, the Ronde van Vlaanderen, in the day used to always start in Ghent, in St. Peter's Station. It was basically a bigger omelette at Volk. And it started in the centre of Ghent, basically, and finished at the other side of Ghent, in Middelbeek. It was only in recent years that they started pushing it all over the place. But I was living at the time with a family in Zomerhem, which is about 12 kilometres out of Ghent. And I thought, you know, a little ego trip. I thought, right, I'll be the first one going through Zomerhem. So as we went along the canals, which used to be a classic photograph, and people used to take photographs from the bridges that went over the canal and over the road, and they got beautiful shots of formations of the echelons, which were already starting, because the Belgians, if there's any wind, boom, straight away an echelon. And they didn't just have one. I've seen times we've been 10 echelons going down that road to Bruges. But anyhow, I made sure that I was going to be at the front. And going through Le Vendigam, I said, right, bonf. And I jumped off up the road, and a few other riders came with me. And as we're coming into Zomerhem, I'm coming up the Dreith, and I made sure I was right at the front, and hello, pop, up, wave here, wave there. Got through Zomerhem, and I thought, right, that's it, finished for the day. I'm going to sit on for a while. Went to the back, and suddenly I noticed a big gap. I thought, oh, look at me, what's happening here? And we were away, and we were about, I'm not sure, 10 or 11 riders, we were clear. I thought, wow, we'd only done about 12K. So I said, that's far too early for me. I'm not going to smash myself in the plains of Flanders before we hit the mountains, before we hit the hills. And so I didn't come through. Now, there were some reasonable riders there. There was one, I mean, the best rider there, really, if you want, not counting myself there, was Noel Fourie, who'd got a hell of a track record, a great rider. He'd won Flanders, he'd won some great races. And been a very loyal helper with Rick Van Looy. And he said, hey, Barry, why aren't you working? I said, Noel, listen, I'll work when we get to the Quaremont. And I wouldn't work, I just sat on. Because I know what happens in these long breaks. People use all their energy and comes to the critical part of the race, and out the back they go, and they get thrown to the four winds. So I sat on. Also, being a Yorkshireman, I'd got an ulterior motive. I knew, and in those days, you went up all the hills that they went in subsequent Flanders, but they weren't all classed. I'll say, well, they've got this hill, they're classing it as a hill. Well, we used to go up there, we didn't class it as a hill. It was just another part of the route, which is what it was. You know, it's like a cobbled section.
Yeah.
If they'd have done that in the 60s, they'd have run out of numbers for the cobbled sections in Flanders.
Because all of the roads are cobbled, yeah.
Yeah. So anyhow, once we came to the Quaremont and you came through Berkham, now I knew all these hills because I used to train up them. And there's a horrible cobbled road. It's about 12K from there, 10 or 12K, up over the top through the Quaremont Woods and dropped down over the other side to Ronsa. Yep. And horrible cobbled road, but a cinder cycle path.
Yeah.
So I started putting the pressure on then, came to the top and got me, I think it's something like 5,000 Belgian francs, which mm-hmm. was a damn good day's work there.
Yeah,
It's probably equivalent today to about a grand.
Yeah.
You know, so I was quite happy about that. And, you know, you didn't have, in those days, you've got to realize, you didn't have the instantaneous communications that you have now. You didn't,
radio
with a motorbike.
Yeah.
With a chalkboard on saying, okay, the bunch is at 2 minutes, 3 minutes, or whatever. And to be quite honest, I have no recollection of ever knowing where the bunch was, because it was so abysmal, the communications we were getting.
Yeah.
I suppose they were probably thinking, well, okay, they're going to get caught. And anyhow, slowly we were dropping riders off. And we got to the Muir. I did the same on the Muir. And slowly we were getting down to the creme, if you wish. And the creme was Noel Forey, myself, and Willie Monty. Well, the other ones had all been dropped. They were just being dropped by the hills. The Muir van Gerardsbergen, that just, you know, the riders just disappeared, if you want. Disappeared backwards. And anyhow, we came along then towards Zottegem, and the last climb was the Kasteelstraat. Now, what people don't realise now is they have to look for the cobble climbs. Now, in the 60s, you didn't have to look for them. They were everywhere.
Yeah.
Cobbled roads everywhere. So it was just par for the course. I mean, people don't realise when you see what you've got now. I mean, I tell some of the British enthusiasts, I said, well, you know that road from Oudenaarde to Ghent? I said, that was cobbled all the way, 40K cobbled road. Now, you couldn't find a 40K cobbled road now. But in those days, heck, the cobbles, they were granite. They never wore out. The only thing that put paint to the cobbled roads was the heavier lorries that started lorries getting heavier and heavier, and then they realised they had to modernise the roads. But anyhow, we came to the Kasteelstraat. Kasteelstraat was less than 20K to go. And I went, you think with hindsight, you can all be experts. And, I suppose I had a bit of a killer instinct, but it wasn't a complete killer instinct. And the way I was going then, I should have gone on the Kasteelstraat, but I didn't.
Yeah.
And I rode up there, and Willie Monty by then was hanging on by his skin of his teeth, if you want. He was smashed completely. So there was only four of myself riding. And naturally, I wasn't going to ride full out, taking anyone on my wheel. And then about 5 or 6K after Zottegem, after the Kasteelstraat, suddenly I heard all the commotion behind of car horns and what have you. And I swung over. And that is crazy. But at that time, I had no idea how much advance we had on the group.
Yeah.
There's no idea, because we were so ill-informed. But that's how it was. Anyhow, I looked behind and I saw some riders coming up. Merckx, who was like a demented beast, was snarling almost. But the idiot brought along two Italians from the same team,
yeah.
Two good Italians, Felice Gimondi and Dino Zandigu. Dino Zandigu was a pretty fast lad. And anyhow, I thought, right, what do we do here? And it was basically what, about another 5-6K after the quarters, and knew they were leading, they recouped a bit, and then they started doing Gimondi and Zandigu started doing the 1-2. Gimondi attacked and Merckx chased. Zandigu attacks and Merckx chased. I wasn't crafty enough. Fauré had been around a long time, and I think he realized that the one that Merckx will counter all the time will be Gimondi, because they were on a par. And there came a moment when Zandigu went and Fauré got his wheel and Merckx didn't move. Ah, and it was too late. It got. And then I wasn't really working. I was just chasing the two. And I realized by then that the bunch wasn't very, very far behind. And I said to Merckx, because Eddie wasn't working very hard then.
Yeah.
You know, he'd basically given up. And I said, Eddie, come on, we've got to ride. You know, I've been away all day long. I don't want to be caught by the bunch in the closing kilometers.
Mm-hmm.
So I started giving it as much as I could. Gimondi was just hanging on, and Eddie was as well. Willie Monty was just, how he hung on, I don't know, but he did. He managed to hang on to us.
Yeah.
And the outcome was in the sprint, well, to come to the sprint for the third place, Merckx won that. Gimondi was just behind him, and I was behind him. But, you know, it was a race of, with hindsight, what I knew when I was more experienced, I think I could have changed the outcome of that race. But that's life. That's bike racing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you mean by going on Castile Strait before Merckx had got to you?
Well, I think that, Chris, I was strong.
Yeah.
I'd played it crafty by not using energy on the plains. When we came to the hills, you know, I wasn't pushing over hard. I was riding at a tempo, but I wasn't killing myself.
Yeah.
And I should have, as Merckx did in a subsequent Ronde van Vlaanderen, I should have done what he'd done. I should have taken the race by the teeth and gone on the Castile Strait. And I reckon Castile Strait, I would have dropped Noel Fauré and dropped Willie Monty, and I would have got clear. Then I could have given it full welly.
Yeah, yeah.
I wasn't before, but right. Who knows?
Brilliant. Okay, we'll press on to 1969, the epic Merckx victory in the Tour of Flanders. That's really famous for.
But 69. You, 69,
yeah. You played a big part in that, didn't you? I think you thought you were the one that antagonised him when you were in the break there.
Well, I think Merckx was easily antagonised, I tell you. Merckx thought, by the time he got to 69, Merckx thought that no one should question his authority on the race. He thought, hey, I'm the big I am. I'm the king. Be mates, ask me, and I'll tell you whether you can go or not. Basically, it was almost like that.
It was his best year, 1969. It was the strongest it ever was.
It was the big year. He'd won some great races before.
Yeah.
But 69, it was his, I am here. Boom. I'm going to make sure you all know I'm here. The race, it was a typical Flanders. The wind was howling on the plains. I went out to the coast, down the coast, and in from the coast, I was heading towards the Kleusbergen. If you get the wind blowing in Flanders, that's when the Ronde van Vlaanderen is a real Ronde van Vlaanderen. And there were etcherons all over the place. There must have been maybe half a dozen etcherons. I was in the second one. And Merckx, I could see, was in the first one, and it was looking damn dangerous. I jumped across, but I had Jos Spruit, he had been a teammate with me with Mercia VP. He was now a teammate with Eddie. I didn't quite make it across, and I said, come on, Jos, come on, come through. I said, I can't, Barry, I can't. I said, Jos, you come through, you can help Eddie. And he was thought about that, and he came through. Boom, we got on. Not many riders individually can jump from one echelon to another.
No.
And so we were clear then, and there were about, we were about, you're talking about the big wide open roads of Flanders. We were possibly about 30 riders. But if you'd have looked back, there were probably six or seven echelons of 20 to 30 riders. It was, because that's how it was.
Yeah.
You couldn't ride in individually then. You had to ride in an echelon. And we were the strong echelon then, and we just went. We just, I mean, there were guys behind like Godefroot and Jan Janssen and the Vlaming. They were all blown to the winds. And once again, I was going through. I wasn't doing any, no heroics. And the old Yorkshire trait came into play. I thought, right, the Quaremont, first spree. We hit Berkham, came through Berkham. We're going up the Cinder Cycle Path. And on that Cinder Cycle Path, you could not get more than two abreast. So basically, you had a single line. Unlike now, it went off to the up the Ron van Vlaanderenstraat, right at the top, where the little hotels are.
Mm-hmm.
And because I was on Merckx's wheel, and Merckx was like in the middle of the Cinder Cycle Path, so I just backed off, well, took a flyer, right to his back wheel, switched onto the cobbles, and went past him.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Well, you explained you were on the Cinder Cycle Path because it was cobbles. That's how you avoided riding on the cobbles. Yep.
Well, yeah, the only way I could get past him was on the cobbles.
Yeah.
And to hit the cobbles, I had to be going faster. So I backed off. When I looked behind, like the Pitosis and the Dancellis and the Gimondis, they were all strung out. There were all gaps all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I took the Prime at the top, and Merckx just looked at me, didn't say anything, just looked. And if looks could have killed, I'd have dropped dead there. But that's life. We dropped down over the other side into Rons, and up the Kreuzberg. And I did the same again to him. Oh, well, this time I think it was, he was annoyed.
Yeah.
Anyhow, the 30 riders that we were, because we had been putting the pressure on, it was starting to reduce. We hit an open section then on the way to Gerardsbergen. And Merckx then just gave it the welly. Now, I said quite often, and few people realize, and few people ever give credit, that Merckx was great. Yes, he was a great rider. No two ways about it. But he had a great team. Merckx was never alone. Never, ever alone. He always had his mates with him. When it all split up and we were in an echelon of 12 riders heading towards the Muir, Eddie had got three teammates. And excuse me, Jos Spruit, Julian Stevens, and Bernard van der Kerkhoff. They were great riders in their own rights. And you knew that if Merckx could produce a gap, if he'd not had his teammates behind him messing everyone else up, then I'm not saying he would never have won. He would have probably won, but he wouldn't have won with the margins that he did win with.
Mm-hmm.
Because you looked at their group, Gimondi was on his own. Pitosi was on his own. Dancelli had got Marino Basso. They were teammates.
Yeah.
But the other guys were all individuals. So
you
had no one sacrificing themselves for another teammate.
Yeah.
But I had no one. Gimondi got no one. And so on. Just when he went on the Muir, well, we went up the normal Muir, then turned off for the Kapellmuir. It already strung people out on the Muir, hit the Kapellmuir, and I was beautifully placed. But the pressure and the speed, it was going up. And slowly, there was half a meter. And eventually, at the top, I think I was about 3 meters behind him. But no one was on a wheel.
Right.
No one. He'd just gone so damned hard that everyone, Pitosi was three lengths off me. Gimondi was 3 lengths off Pitosi, and so on. Got to the top, and we didn't. Well, I didn't think, and I don't think the others thought. We didn't think. It was still 79K to go. And there were still hills in between, the Motzberg and a few others.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he thought, well, hang on, he's not going to continue like that. So I got to the top, And I was, I eased. Pitossi got onto my wheel, he eased. Gimondi got onto that, he eased. So we all eased.
Yeah.
But straight away, Merckx had got 30, 40 seconds clear.
Yeah.
By then, his teammates were up with us. By the time we started trying to get ourselves organised, every second wheel was one of Merckx's teammates. When you block, you're just there. You ride second wheel, as I say. So the ride at the front, putting full pressure on, and you just ease slightly and make a little gap. So the guy who's on Merckx's teammate's wheel has got to come over Merckx's teammate and then do a bit.
Yeah.
So it's complete disruption.
Yeah.
And before long, minute, 2 minutes, and by then it was fait accompli.
Yeah.
Everyone knew then. And also, the weather was changing. It was raining, sleet, it was cold, and I hated the cold.
Yeah.
And I was frozen to the bone. So anyhow, that's how it was. When we got to the finish, well, I'd got wooden legs at the finish. So I was there, but I didn't have a sprint left in my legs.
Yeah.
But I finished seventh. But yeah, you can't complain in what later became a monument. But in those days, if you'd have said a monument in those days, people would have said, what do you mean? It was a classic. It was a classic. The journalists and the whoever got this thing, the podium, click, click. You know, hang on, podium? I finished second and third in many races. I never went on the podium. The only one who went on the podium was the winner.
In 1974, you got your own back on Merckx in the Gent-Wevelgem, another fantastic cobbled classic. Tell us the story about that. That was a midweek race. And it was your best year, wasn't it, 74? You were in the best team you ever had. And you actually had some teammates in the break.
74 was, strangely enough, when you think, I was 34 years old, and it was my pinnacle season, if you wish. It was a Gent-Mercier team, and it was a height of our fame, if you wish.
Yeah.
We were winning. Merckx was beaten in Paris-Nice. Jupp beat him in the Cement Catalonia.
Yeah.
So suddenly, you know, boy, we were laying the law down. We were almost like sharing races.
Mm-hmm.
In Flanders, I punched it at a bad time and got back to the main group, but there was a group went clear, and Kees Baal, who was a very good Dutch guy, very good Dutch rider. Quite often in Flanders, it was a new finish then near Ninove.
Yeah.
And quite often, when you got a group, like, you know, six or seven riders, no one wanted to take anyone.
Yeah.
And so it was jump, chase, jump, chase, jump, chase. And when Kees went, no one moved. He had a bit of luck. You know, some of the big riders were chasing the other big riders.
Yeah.
And Kees won. So that was a good omen. So we came to Gent-Wevelgem and feeling good again. I could always get up the nasty cobble climbs that there were in Flanders and in West Flanders on the Kemmel.
Yeah.
I love these climbs. In those days, you had this circuit of climbs when you hit the, what's called the Heuvelland.
Yeah.
You had the Zwarteberg, the Rodeberg, the Molenberg, and then the Kemmel.
Yeah, the Kemmelberg.
Yeah. And even though I think it had split up a bit, there was still a sizable group. But you did the first lap around the hills.
Yes, because there were several laps, wasn't there, of this circuit?
Yeah, it was a circuit. It was a circuit around the hills. And the last time up, you're talking like, I think when you got to the top of the Kemmelberg, it was like 40 kilometres from there to the finish. I had a problem with my gears. And anyone who, this was before the retrofriction levers and things like that were in existence. And when you're on a hard, steep climb with the old Campag gear levers, they used to move of their own accord. Mm-hmm. And we had no way. We tried everything, flattening the screw and what have you. But still, and you need it. I always put a 22 on for the Camelback. And anyhow, I was well placed, right, with Merckx and de Vlaeminck and everyone. But my gear lever kept moving, and I kept having to sit down and one hand on the handlebar and one on the gear lever. Not ideal. And I lost quite a few meters. Went over the top, and the main group of guys, once they got clear of Kemmel at the bottom, heading towards Meenen, they weren't hanging around. I was not right with them, but there were individuals in between. And I was moving well and catching. And I think I was the last one to get onto the critical echelon that was going away.
To get into that front echelon, yeah.
The wind was coming from the right, and they were reducing the size of the echelon by riding on the left.
Yeah.
And I was there, right in the gutter, and I was saying, please go to the right, please go to the right. Suddenly they went to the right, and whoop,
You got in.
I was in, yeah. And that was it. And if you'd look behind, there were bodies everywhere. Anyhow, that was it. And we were actually 17 riders clear.
Yeah.
I had teammates there. But, you know, in those days, no one rode for you.
No.
Mourinho was riding for himself. Alan Sonti was riding for himself. You got someone like Alan Sonti, there was no way was Alan going to win that race.
No.
But he was still riding for his place.
Yeah.
He didn't ride for me. Poulidor was going to get a good place, and he was riding for himself. So as we're coming into the last 10K, you've always got guys who are going to take flyers. You had some good guys for doing that. You had Jean-Pierre Danguillon, who was a classic at doing that,
yes,
taking a flyer in the last 5K. Yep. Herman Van Springel, another one.
Yeah.
And Tino Tabak. So there are quite a few guys whose speciality was taking a flyer in the closing kilometres. And so the wind wasn't the critical point then, but the mm-hmm. group was going, switching from left to right, from right to left, from left to right. And there were little gaps appearing all the time. Yeah. I do remember screaming at Poulidor, Raymond, push me through, close the gap. Because I didn't want to be using my energy.
Yeah.
Until we came to the last K. And I think Tino Tabak had gone just before and he was wrapped up. No one had lead out men's.
Yeah, no.
There was no, you know, I think it's very rare that someone sacrificed themselves in a sprint like that.
Yeah.
Not in a classic. And so they're all like itchy legs, just waiting to go. And then whatever it was, 300 meters to go, 400 meters to go, boom, the speed went up. And I was beautifully placed, but I had a wall of riders in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd got a term I used. I knew I had my overdrive.
Yeah.
And I knew that I could just...
You could feel it. You could feel it in your legs.
Up the cadence, and I could go.
Uh-huh.
But I couldn't go because there was no gap.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, I think it was between Eric LeMond and Roger de Vlaeminck, they opened up. Oh, mm-hmm. Well, I didn't ask twice. I went straight through that gap, and the overdrive kicked in. Well, when I was sprinting well, I could sprint. The harder the race, the better my sprint.
Yeah.
And boy, I just flew. And if you see any photographs, it wasn't inches. It was a good length between me and Merckx.
Yeah.
So, a great deal of satisfaction.
And Merckx was second and de Vlaeminck third.
De Vlaeminck was third, yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you had guys like Godefroot, Freddy Mertens, Verbeek, Walter Plancart, Eric Lamont, all these guys. He had some superb riders there.
Dream of Belgian cycling.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm just a bit disappointed, if you want. Deep down, there were no Italians there. I would have loved to have had a Gianni Motta and a Bitossi and a Gimondi there.
Yeah.
I think they're about the only race, the only classic that everyone rode was Milan San Remo.
Right, right.
Because the other, even in Flanders or Roubaix or Wevelgem or Liège-Bastogne-Liège, not everyone rode. I say quite often that an Italian could have a whole career and never leave Italy.
Well, yeah, yeah, yeah. Right, well, so get on to the last race of gold, of what was Golden Week, Flanders, Wevelgem, and the final on the Sunday with Paris-Roubaix. And you have the best place in equal with Ian Stannard and Roger Hammond, of third place in Paris-Roubaix in 1972. And it was a race also you felt you could have won that day. You did have a lot of bad luck. I mean, they had a luck to get into that position, but you you fought yourself back into that position twice, didn't you?
Yeah. You know, I always had, no matter what my form was, I don't know why. You'd think I was a Flandrian, because I was hyped up all the time for the Cobble Classics.
Yeah.
They were races. I was a bit of a poser. And the races, I didn't mind getting dirty in.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though I didn't like getting dirty.
But no.
Such is life. But Jean Stablinski used to always say, Paris-Roubaix, there's two races in that race. Paris-Valenciennes and Paris-Roubaix. Because there was a feed in Valenciennes just before the Arenberg Forest.
Yeah, yeah.
And many riders who'd done the work took the feed at Valenciennes and got in the team cars. They'd finished their race. And also, it's like Flanders and all these other races. The last 100K, that's when the men took over from the boys.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I was riding well. I rode Paris-Roubaix total 13 times.
Wow.
Two or three times, I didn't finish for whatever reason.
Yeah.
You know, you punch it. There's no point. No point riding on when the team cars are all in front of you. We didn't have the service that we have today.
No.
How would you got back to Roubaix?
That's right.
But anyhow, I was riding well, and I was right up with the main actors in the scene, if you wish.
Yeah.
In the Arenberg Forest.
Yeah.
Now, they always say when you puncture, you've got to puncture in the right time.
Yeah.
But never puncture in the wrong time. The problem with the Arenberg is just before in Valenciennes, the majority of the field is still there.
Yes.
Team cars are miles behind.
Mm-hmm.
I punctured. Oh, damn. Now, as I mentioned before, I should have been a protected rider in Paris-Roubaix, but you weren't. You know, get on with it. A lesser light would ride past you. Jacques Cadio did stop and give me his wheel.
Yeah, your teammate, Jacques Cadio.
A good French rider.
Yeah,
but the team cars are still miles behind. So then I had to chase. I'd lost over 2 minutes. You not only have the road to contend with, you've got riders who have been smashed, dropped, and what have you to get round.
So you were chasing through the Arenberg Forest.
This is after the Arenberg Forest when you get through.
Yeah,
and I'm chasing like hell. And to this day, I've no idea how long I chased. I probably chased for 40K.
Crikey!
And I eventually got back to the Merckx group, and De Vlaeminck, everyone was still there. But I'd taken a few risks on the corners. Back wheel I got from Jacques Cadio was pretty buckled.
Yeah.
Wasn't punctured, so arm in the air. By then, the team cars were coming out. And even though I'd got Poulidor in the leading group, and Eddie Pillman. Now, once again, today, both those riders would have been riding for me. I got the best chance.
Yeah.
But no, they were riding for themselves. Typical thing. Anyhow, Cappy, you give me a wheel. But hey, you're chasing on your own. You still lose 30, 40 seconds.
Yeah, so this was from the
by
team
time
car.
I got back after another hard effort, De Vlaeminck had gone. Because by then, we're coming into the last 50K. And I'm taking having a breather, and boom, Dirks went. And I still haven't got my breath back. So I had to, you've got to pick your moment before you jump. I wasn't going to ride at the front and try and ride them all off my wheel. And unfortunately, we were running out of kilometres. By the time I jumped, I attacked, which finished the cobbles. We came into Hem, and I knew Hem, there's a false flat drag, which under normal circumstances wouldn't count. But hey, you got some hard miles in your legs, hard kilometres.
Yeah.
And I dropped to the back of the group. I don't know how many we were. We were only about 10 riders. And I went up the gutter. So they were all looking on the right, and I went on the left. And I got clear. I'd still got form there. And I was really flying. I came onto the boulevards, because I was only about 5K to go then.
Yeah.
I came onto the boulevards. A poor Willie van Maldegem, who'd been in the very early break, managed to hang on and hang on and hang on. And De Vlaeminck had gone past him like three times as fast. Dirks had gone past him. And when I went past him, off. How he was staying on his bike, I don't know. But unfortunately, even though I think I was going faster than Dirks and De Vlaeminck.
Yes, you were. You were catching them, yes. Yeah.
If there'd been another cobbled section, another if's not going to do it. But I was 15K short of doing better than third.
Yes, yeah. Brilliant.
Once again, you finish on the podium. There was no podium.
No.
The only one who got the accolade was Roger.